Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
This week,
we discuss the difference between Max Fac and the customs partnership and whether or not anyone has got any interest in finding out the difference between them.
We talk about what I did on my holidays.
And you ask us, would Tessa Jowell have won the London mayoralty? Stephen, I'm so excited to talk about Brexit.
I am actually genuinely thrilled to talk about Brexit.
That's a lie. That's a massive lie. You don't look thrilled.
I honestly am. I'm thrilled in the context of the NS podcast, where it can be slightly more discursive. I'm terrified about it in the context of my free morning email.
GDPR compliant, I should stress.
Is it?
Yeah, because everybody who signed up to it definitely agreed to sign up to it.
Okay. Well, I hope anyway.
Hey, we're leaving the EU. Hey, it turns out everything's related to Brexit. So here's the thing. You were away last week, much missed. Although Sienna Rogers from Labour List came in, very nice. She gave us a very good debrief on the local election results. So therefore, you missed about the idea that the Cabinet is now, and the War Committee, is now hesitating between maximum facilitation, MaxFac, and the idea of a customs partnership. Now, let's explain this one, right, because I want to die every time I do this. The difference is, and correct me if I'm wrong, customs partnership, we track goods much more efficiently, work out which ones have a final destination in the EU, collect tariffs on all of them, and then reimburse as needed. Maximum facilitation is something about airships.
So maximum facilitation is you have trusted trader schemes which allow a lot of people to go past, and you do have some border infrastructure. So there are two things you can say in favour of maximum facilitation, or MaxFac, as everyone took to calling it while I was away. The first is that it exists in the real world, right? I know that
feels... Who uses it already then?
Well, it's basically what Switzerland, Norway, et cetera, et cetera. If you have a border that's not militarized, I mean, to the extent that any border is not militarized, but do you have any...
If you're not North and South Korea.
Well, yeah, or if you're not US-Mexico even, right? Yeah. If you have a kind of open border with a kind of fairly liberal migration regime, and you're not at military loggerheads with the other side, you basically have some version of MaxFac. The crucial but here is that any real-world version of MaxFac has more border infrastructure than the no-border infrastructure the UK government has committed to on Northern Ireland. And obviously, as you all know, having been to the Irish border recently, signs and, you know, kind of things are regularly defaced. All of the border towns are represented now by Sinn Féin MPs, right? So this idea that if you have, you know, goods checks for the occasional lorry, then that is not going to be the site for at least some political violence is for the birds. However, I can't believe that I've got to the point where I'm now grading the Brexiteers on a curve. But it is a positive step for two reasons. One, as I say, it exists in the real world, right? So you've just got to kind of give them that. The second is that at least now they've acknowledged that they have decided that a hard border is a price they are willing to pay for the right to have a trade deal with Djibouti or wherever. And so, again, those are both bad situations, but at least we're no longer arguing about, you know,
whether
the unicorn.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I just feel like where the parliamentary... It's really hard. So I was just... saying to you, I've been reading this book by Stephen Gross, which is about psychoanalysis, and it's talking about a restaurant fire in which people died because they were queuing to pay, right? And about the fact that we're just not very good. Like, we take our signals so much from other people about whether or not something is scary, which happens in the other direction with stampedes and you know, crowd tragedies. But my worry about Brexit is I keep hearing things that I think, this is really bad. Like, have you been following the row over Galileo?
Yep.
So basically what happened was the US was in charge of all satellites, you know, 20 years ago, and therefore we were entirely dependent on it for sat-nav and all the kind of things, you know, everything like Uber or everything, all these apps now that your, you know, GPS, it depends on. So we sort of thought, wouldn't it be good if we had our own version? Europe's got its own version. And now there's a massive row about the fact none of the contracts for that will be given in going forward to British firms. We're now refusing all the British firms that are currently involved in it, saying that they wouldn't share their sensitive data with, you know, the new firms that would take all the business off them, which would then slow this project down for 3 years, maybe more. So it's one of those things where, you know, that's the kind of thing that people will notice. Like, if that kind of, you know, if that completely stalls into something, it's just completely needless bureaucratic wrangling and loss of really, let's be honest, those are going to be really great high-tech jobs.
Yeah, I mean, so to kind of loop back around briefly to the customs partnership, which has the advantage in it, is better and doesn't have these negative externalities, but it doesn't exist in the real world. But I think the thing with stuff like Galileo is that it will be hard, I think, to tell to what extent job losses are about Brexit and to what extent they are about our cruddy economy.
A general economic downturn, which may or may not be caused by Brexit.
Now, I mean, I think it will be open and shut and, you know, people deciding to move elsewhere, you know, so to move within the EU27, what that will be about. But I think it will be quite muddy, unless, of course, now the weird thing is, obviously, the British political establishment loves World War II metaphors, but actually the metaphor that should be troubling them is just World War One, because no one in 1914 wanted to trigger
an epic Europe-wide conflict leading to the deaths of millions of people in the mud of northern France.
And even the people who talk about no deal, they actually don't mean no deal. They mean they want a very limited skeleton deal, which goes, here's why flights will happen, here's why cancer treatment will still happen, we will arrange the rest elsewhere, slash we'll be bumped into an indefinite transition. They don't actually mean no deal. However, the World War II scenario of ending up with a no deal that no one actually wants is, you know, it's a non-trivial possibility.
There
right?
is this sort of weird thing that happens all the time, which is like, well, if the only reason why we're not getting a deal on the border is because Ireland are, you know, are just refusing, you know, they're being, you know, obstructive, and you're kind of like, well, no, they're having negotiating priorities, you know, and they're the other half in a negotiation.
But also,
it does reveal the fundamental interconnectedness of the world. Like, we can't take off our planes and just fly them into French airspace. That's just not a thing that we can now do. Maybe you could have done it in 1940, but not now.
The thing is with the kind of Ireland is being difficult, right, is and actually, the British government is also committed to not having border infrastructure. The British government is also a signatory to the Good Friday Agreement, which is an international treaty. This kind of weird Brexiteer meme. And the one thing they are good at is moving goalposts. I mean, they can't implement anything. They have no real-world policy proposals, but they are excellent at lowering bars and moving goalposts. Because it's not that Ireland has gone, we don't want a hard border, and the UK government has gone, well, we don't, we're entirely relaxed about it. I mean, none of our voters really care about it. I mean, who are these people? Is Northern Ireland, do they have the same currency? I mean, although, to be frank, I feel that if you ride up the average MP to a lie detector, many of those comments would not trouble the polygraph. But, you know, the UK government also doesn't want border infrastructure. So we're not even negotiating with someone else. We have a series of policy objectives for Brexit which cannot be reconciled with one another.
But so also Holyrood this week voted down a key bit of their need to approve something. The Lords keep sending stuff back. And then Theresa May has been talking about putting back some of those votes until maybe even until after the summer recess. But, you know, this is what I don't understand. It's one of those things where you think, am I going crazy? Because I think this all sounds really very, very worrying. And yet nobody seems as worried as I would expect them to be. So maybe I'm the mad one. Maybe it will all work out okay. Maybe there will be some glorious last minute deus ex machina will come. You know what I mean? But I think it's very alarming that in the last couple of weeks we started hearing Brexiteers talking about wanting to extend the transition period, when having a transition period at all is conditional on us agreeing a skeleton outline with the EU.
Well, as Emily Thornberry said in her, you know, the problem is if you hold blah, blah, blah up to the six tests, which was a classic example of a politician being 100% right, but not having been a good idea for them to say it out loud. And this might just be woeful, kind of blind optimism, but seeing as if I'm wrong, people won't be able to call me out on it, seeing as I doubt that I will be special correspondent at the New Statesman at that point, or indeed, you know...
There won't be a New Statesman.
The matter won't arise. I think actually a transition with a very vague kind of there will be an FTA of some form, shape, or function is fairly likely.
That's where I would bet. If I had to currently bet, I would bet that we would leave the single market, but not the customs union.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that ultimately there just aren't the votes. You know, kind of before you get into the psychodrama about, you know, does Corbyn dislike the EU? Well, yes, obviously, but actually, it doesn't really matter what Corbyn's personal view is. The collective state of the Labour Party means that there is not 325 votes to stay in the single market. There are 325 votes to stay in the customs union.
But I also think the one thing that I have learned about Jeremy Corbyn that is contrary to the image that everybody had of him at the start is that he does pursue a politics of priorities, right? There are things that matter more to him and less to him, and the things that he will throw under the bus.
Yeah, but I also think ultimately in some ways, while that is true, it just also doesn't matter in terms of the single market question. So at the PLP this week, Jeremy Corbyn disappointed a lot of people by saying his spokesman by saying, look, we're not going to vote for this EEA amendment. But actually, the important person who spoke at that meeting was not Jeremy Corbyn, not his spokesperson. It was John Speller, the MP for... Why have I committed myself to doing this?
I don't know. Something, the word Carl Shulton popped into my head, but then I went...
No, that's Tom Brake.
Yeah, I don't know why.
John Speller, the MP for...
Something Valley. No. Wow, this is embarrassing, Stephen.
All I can keep hearing myself Bromley, which is where he was MP for first, but it's not where he's the MP for anymore. But, it was John Speller and John Mann, other MPs who didn't speak but who would have agreed with them, Caroline Flint or whatever, right? But crucially, there are more Labour MPs.
And what did John Speller say?
He said, well, look, we can't go into the EEA. That's not what the referendum was about. The referendum was about free movement of people, yada, yada, yada. You know, we can't have the four freedoms. Now...
I think that is not an unreasonable, but it's one I personally disagree with. But I think in political calculation terms, what did people vote on in Brexit? They voted on immigration and the economy. Either the idea that you could have lower immigration, whether or not it would dent the economy, you know, really affected how huge chunk of people in the middle voted. So I think if you're going to be seen to be delivering what people asked for, something that you signed up to, actually the customs partnership or customs Maxfac or customs union, all of those are kind of irrelevant. I just don't think you're going to get punished by voters for going into the customs union.
No, I think that is true. I mean, I think, although of course I know I've said this before, but one of the problems with Brexit is that because the government didn't agree with the change proposition, you'd have this kind of chimerical result where you can kind of go, what's that? So there's kind of what I think of as the haster at Brexit, which is the Brexit then the majority of people in the voting majority voted for, which does obviously mean leaving the single market, ending free movement of people, et cetera, et cetera. However, the number of people who wanted to stay in the single market who voted Brexit is bigger by any kind of serious study, right? Is bigger than the margin. So there is an open question about whether or not you then have a 55% support Brexit, but where the majority of the people who support that form of Brexit voted to stay in the EU, and then you effectively build a new coalition with a tiny slither of people who wanted to leave the EU in different circumstances. I mean, the difficulty is I have two very strong reactions to that, which I can't reconcile with one another. The first is that feels instinctively wrong and anti-democratic to me, right? The majority of people who voted to leave wanted to be free of at least one of the four freedoms. But my second reaction is that, seeing as 52% of people did not want to be free of the four freedoms, and I think being free of the four...
48% of people didn't want to be free of the
52%,
four freedoms.
No, as in, like, you don't get a majority of people. You don't get a majority to leave with just the votes of people who wanted to be free of the four freedoms.
Okay, I see what you mean.
And so it's just democratically murky whichever outcome you pursue. But it doesn't matter because ultimately the government has no bandwidth, is failing to negotiate with it, can't agree anything, cannot pass anything by both the majority of the Tory party and the majority of the House of Commons, which means we will end up, if we agree anything at all, with an indefinite transition. And then this weird, prolonged and probably indefinite period in which every time we come to the end of a budgetary round at the EU. So the reason why this transition, as currently agreed, goes up to 2021, is that's the end of this budget round. The will in the EU27, based on the MEPs I've talked to and people in the Commission, is one, there's an expectation that transition will go on for much longer, because there's also an expectation that Britain will not become more governable in the next 5-10 years. But it does mean you're going to have this situation where every time you come to the end of a budget round, it'll be like, well, is the UK going to extend its transition?
And therefore, is it going to keep paying into the EU budget?
And is it going to keep paying into the EU budget?
And those will be eye-watering headline sums, right?
Four freedoms, yeah. And you will have, you know, the kind of politics you see in the United States around the debt ceiling, with kind of these sort of
the government shutdown,
juddering crises of, you know, well, is the government going to extend? Is it not going to extend? And that feels to me to be the most likely dynamic. Now, the question is to kind of slightly look back at the local elections, right? Isn't one of the subplots of those contests was the Conservatives did much better, and in terms of their hopes of staying in office in some kind of minority arrangement, their hopes rest on the fact that they seem to have a kind of small town / Leave voters firewall. Then the Labour Party did worse than it needs to do to win power in small towns, in a place where Leave voters
gathered.
You know
who else had a firewall? Hillary Clinton.
Well, I mean, the nature of firewalls is they are inevitably breached. But the thing that would trouble me were I a Conservative is, at what point do Leave voters stop voting?
Like Leave voters.
Is it when Brexit is resolved, when we've left and agreed a transition? Is it throughout the time of transition? And crucially, do Remain voters also behave in the same way? Or do they behave in a more, is the Remain coalition more sticky, as it were? Now, it feels to me that there are many reasons to suppose that the Remain coalition will be more sticky, not least because they will have lost, and people who have lost tend to be more likely to cohere around something because they have something they still want.
But also, if there are definite obvious bad side effects to Brexit, it becomes harder to identify yourself as a Brexiteer rather than somebody who thought this was a good idea but has now kind of really gone off it. Or like the politicians, they're all the same. All of those things that you hear all the time on the doorsteps whenever you follow politicians around campaigning.
The thing is that if Brexit does go badly, whose incentive is it to point out, you know, if you're the opposition party, it's never in your interest to go, we've got a crappy economy because of a choice made by you, a third of the voters, or whatever it will be from demographic drift. At that point, it's always their interest to go, the problem is the other party, which is why you should vote for me. So I don't necessarily think that the Leave vote will overnight be seen as a mistake. It is clear to me what, if you are a Remainer, social liberal, et cetera, and you're voting for the Labour Party, I can understand what it is that Labour is offering you other than their Brexit position. Certainly they're not offering you very much as far as their Brexit position goes. Whereas if you are a small town Leave voter who's voting for the Conservatives, who voted for Labour in 2015 and switched over, or voted for another party and switched over, it is not clear to me what those voters are being offered economically, politically, in terms of social infrastructure, other than we will leave the EU. And that would trouble me if I were a Conservative putting a lot of faith in my firewall.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, Stephen, you last week went on a trip to Israel with impeccable timing, just because it's been an incredible week of events there. So the US moved its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, followed by, I think you said, Paraguay and somewhere.
So Guatemala have now followed suit, and Paraguay are due to do so in the next sort of coming days.
But not least is the fact that I'm going to get my days mixed up. But this week was Nakba Day, the 70th anniversary of the State of Israel being created, and also for Palestinians, a day where they've been organizing. Hamas and other people have organized into the Great Return March, which culminated on Monday in a lot of people attempting to storm the border fence in Gaza, Israel opening fire on them and killing, I think the death toll is now above 50 people, including some children. I think it was a baby who died from tear gas. Huge international outcry over it. The US seems entirely unbothered.
And protests in Tel Aviv about it.
Yeah. But the US seems entirely unbothered about the fact that this catastrophically unnecessary decision to move their embassy, which was always something that was held out as a kind of carrot for the continuation of the peace process, has led to all of these deaths. So you weren't there for that, but you were there the week before. How febrile was the atmosphere when you were there?
Well, the thing people kept saying to us is, I know that people always say, oh, you've come at an interesting time, but you've really come at a... Now, the thing is actually the embassy move is a, in my view, is a bad decision for a variety of reasons, but it's actually not all that linked to the killing of these protesters, which is much more linked to the anniversary and also the fact that essentially the fear that the IDF has is that some of the people who are moving towards the fence have Molotov cocktails, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, some of them do. However, bluntly, Daniel Sugarman wrote a very good piece on this for the Jewish Chronicle, which I think is exactly right. There is simply no argument that the way to deal with in a crowd of thousands
armed with rocks is sniper rifles.
Well, also just a couple of thousands. Some of them who are not are armed with worse things than rocks. But ultimately, it's not a it is the definition of a disproportionate rock to shoot live rounds at people, many of whom are unarmed. As well as being immoral, it's also stupid. It is actively a bad decision for Israel's security as well. But that is entirely separate from the politics of the embassy move. It was stupid of the US to have their big, oh, we're going to have a big song and dance about this move in this very fraught anniversary at the start of Ramadan, just at a time when there are many, many reasons why things could kick off, and you have the kind of contrast of photos of
Ivanka, that was the thing, it was the
smiling
split screen,
and opening
yeah.
things, and, children and armed protesters being gunned down, right? So it was stupid to do it at that time. But the problem with moving the embassy is then both Israel and Palestine see Jerusalem as their capital. Oslo, which for a variety of reasons came unstuck after...
You mean the Oslo talks rather than the Norwegian city,
yeah,
per se?
Came unstuck after the agreement in 1996. But almost everyone accepts that you are going to have some kind of shared sovereignty of... either shared sovereignty of holy sites or some kind of... So what Oslo had was effectively an invisible partition. So you had areas of shared sovereignty. There was no war between East and West Jerusalem, but both countries were able to use it as their capital. So the problem with the US moving their embassy there, the argument runs, is that that effectively means they are explicitly taking a side by putting an embassy in the city now when its status in
saying
any
it's Israel's capital
process, yeah. has not been able to. So I actually don't think that is really true. Ultimately, if there's lasting peace, it will be because there is a viable Palestinian state that doesn't have, its power intermittently taken off. It doesn't have parts of it run by people who want to wipe Israel off the map, and where unarmed protesters aren't shot, and where, crucially, both nations have a shared claim to Jerusalem. But that will only happen with the with brave leadership on the Israeli and Palestinian sides. And where the US embassy is, I think, is entirely irrelevant to whether or not you have that brave leadership. I mean, it's a slight...
I disagree with you. I think it's a really strong signal that the US are not... I know not they ever were honest brokers in this, but you know what I mean? That they are entirely... They just entirely align themselves with Benjamin Netanyahu and his government as it's currently constituted. That they actually don't... What are they, what things are they kind of holding out as, what are the carrots that they're holding out? What is the kind of process that they're holding out to Palestine and Palestinians?
But the location of the embassy isn't a carrot. Now, ultimately, you're talking about a city which has the parliament, the central bank, all of the governmental buildings.
But I think it's a signal about saying, this is the side that we're going to come down on. This is the side that we favour. I mean, not that that was ever in any doubt, given the enormous amount of military aid that they give to Israel. But you know what I mean? I just think as a symbolic thing, I think it was extremely ill-timed.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it matters beyond it being a boost to Netanyahu's hopes of re-election. Although the problem, of course, is in some ways the success of Netanyahu is a bit like the success of austerity in Western Europe, right? Where you go, we have a terrible economy, we need to tighten our belts and make these tough decisions. So you tighten your belts, the economy gets worse, and then you can turn to the voters and go, see, look how bad the economy is. Netanyahu's message is effectively... the Europeans don't like us. They don't understand what it's like to survive in a tough neighborhood. Can't trust half of the US political establishment. You need me. And one of Netanyahu's massive assets is he has great English, much better than basically any of the Israeli politicians he's gone up against in recent elections. He said, and goes, yeah, look, I know how to make deals with these people in this tough neighborhood. I'm tough and strong. I know how to sock it to these Europeans and make deals with Americans. And as a result of his foreign policy choices, the Europeans distrust Israel more. They have more difficulties in their local neighborhood. And the bipartisan support for the state of Israel in the United States takes another blow. So it becomes true. And his appeal to 25-35% of the Israeli electorate becomes stronger. And that puts him in the box seat for coalition negotiations. And that sort of vicious circle, I don't think really needs. And I kind of think it slightly excuses the decisions made by the Likud party to go, oh, well, the problem is that Trump has given in to this nutter butter demand of a bunch of people on the American far right. I mean, it is a nutter butter demand, but it doesn't, I think, particularly matter.
One thing I wanted to ask, you wrote a notebook for the magazine this week and you went to the Golan Heights Cafe, so along Israel's disputed border with Syria. On a clear day, you can see there, from there, you can see shelling happening on few rebel-held cities in Syria.
So there wasn't any shelling when we went there. I mean, the weird thing, of course, wherever you go in the world is this kind of amazing endurance of capitalism's ability to sell you stuff, which is even better in Jerusalem, where you have kind of holy relics. And it's like, I see you have a menorah and also a crucifix.
They both light up. How adorable.
It's like, you're clearly committed to all three of these faiths. But and you go on the Golan Heights and you can buy a cup of coffee and then sit, and you can see one of the last rebel cities. And when we arrived, they apologized for the fact that they were going to have to close early because they said, well, you know, the children will wake up in the night because they will be able to hear shelling from Assad's forces onto this one of the few remaining rebel-held cities. And it felt like a really weird microcosm of, and I know we will, I imagine, discuss this many, many times before the end of the Syrian civil war, the weird things that everyone outside Syria have decided they do and do not care about in the Syrian civil war. So obviously we have this weird thing where we keep going, oh, you know, you can't incentivize Assad to use chemical weapons. I mean, he's going to get to stay. He's been incentivized, right?
But, yeah, there is definitely a kind of thing that comes up every time we have the chemical weapons debate, where it's like the fact that he's gassing civilians is unacceptable to us. The fact that he's shelling civilians, you know, is unacceptable. Like, and I can see there is a point about what stuff is used, but nonetheless, we have basically signed off on the idea that he can kill as many of his own people as he wants, as long as he does it in like our approved set of ways, which is fundamentally
And also
weird.
In terms of the calculus about you can't reward the use of chemical weapons, well, he's going to get to stay. So what is the non-reward? But it feels to me that the British political establishment has reached this consensus where we've decided that Assad will win the Syrian civil war, we will intermittently bomb an empty airfield, and there will be a round of isn't Jeremy Corbyn beastly in large chunks of the British press. And that is that is what we have decided to care about in Syria. Now, Israel has is doing a lot more for people on the Syrian border than the British government is. But they similarly have this weird thing where they've now formalized a program where IDF medics in the field are going, well, look, I've done the Hippocratic Oath, so I'm not going to leave this person to die, where people are medevaced out of Syria, fixed up in an Israeli hospital, and then
bundled back out again.
And it has this thing of just like, right, so again, the symbol is the kind of the message that the whole world has sent is that provided Assad kills people fairly quickly without using chemical weapons, that's fine. But if he injures them, their neighbors will patch them up in hospitals. And if he uses gas bombs, then by God, the might of the West will flatten an empty airfield.
Once we told the Russians and the Iranians to get out of it.
Yeah, and it is just a kind of bleak and utterly surreal kind of microcosm of sort of the hilariously bad and grimly bad failed interventions in the Arab Spring and failed non-interventions in the Arab Spring. I mean, at every stage.
And the complete failure of the UN as an inter-supranational disputes body now.
Yeah, although Libya, of course, was a UN-backed, the P5 did all back it. Yeah, and so that was kind of interesting but bleak.
And now time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So this week's question is about Tessa Jowell, who sadly died last weekend at the age of 70. And essentially it's kind of appraising her strengths and weaknesses as a politician, I would say, by saying what would the London mayoral race have looked like had she run it. She was endorsed by the NS. I think Jason in particular was very impressed with her work on the London Olympics. She had a big reputation for working kind of on cross-party stuff. Obviously, I think the main plank of her legacy is Sure Start, now sadly being, disemboweled.
And 24-hour drinking.
Yeah.
A big Crosland-eye aim. It was like crossing the future of socialism. We talked about the need for, you know, pleasant open spaces because people, quite rightly, because people deserve, you know, the equal access to beauty and green space is an important progressive issue. And yeah, open plazas on the European model with people being able to drink 24 hours. So yes, she achieved that.
So there are three things that I think that happened because Sadiq Khan won the nomination that wouldn't have happened if Tessa Jowell had won it. And I think they're all quite important. The fact is that he played the Corbyn, no Corbyn zigzag extremely well. So he nominated Corbyn for the Labour leadership, banked a lot of credit for that, then came out, I think, the weekend after he got the Labour primary nomination and did an interview with the Mail on Sunday in which he went, call by me, Governor, geezer, marry a London taxi, I love the Queen, here's my Union Jack. And so he could kind of successfully calibrated his message of, like, you know, appealing to the Labour left, but also then like tacking much more back to the centre. The second is that I think his campaign was absolutely excellent at selling him as a narrative. And about his background, you know, the sort of son of a bus driver, and now he's headed for City Hall, you know, raised in a council house, now he's going to build, you know, more houses for you. I thought that bit of the campaign was calibrated extremely well. It fused biography and political sensibility really well. And the third thing is the disastrous, ill-advised and, you know, frankly, gross Islamophobia that was levelled at him by the Linton Crosby run Zach Goldsmith campaign, where they went, ooh, bus bombers, ooh, they're Muslim, he's Muslim, coincidence, I think not. And the dog whistling that failed. And those are three things I think would have all played out very differently. So there might have been another route for Tessa Jowell to win it, but three of the things I think really contributed to his win would not have been there for her.
I mean, I disagree. I mean, obviously, I start from a perspective that I have an incredibly large protester bias, because when we first met, there was a point in our respective careers when she had no need to be as kind and generous with her time as she was, which I think was a very common experience for people at Westminster about her. But we forget that she did phenomenally well in that selection for someone who was, you know, a sufficiently pipe cane of paid up Blairite partisan, that she gave Ed Balls her fifth preference in 2010. She was on the record saying she would, you know, fall under a bus for Tony,
the blessed Toblerone, yeah.
And yet she, you know, she did not lose that badly. She did significantly better. When you think about how many votes Corbyn got out of London the leadership race, right? She got a phenomenal number of Corbyn won, Tessa won votes, right? So she was, she ran an incredibly astute campaign. And, you know, did very well to not lose by more.
Her policy proposals were very good as well. I remember she on housing, particularly about building on TfL land and things like that, were very impressive.
But crucially, although every time I do this, Corbyn skeptics get annoyed with me, there is literally no evidence that Sadiq Khan did better than like a generic like vegetable with I love Corbyn tattooed on him, with the exception of two places, his home constituency of Tooting, where he just did phenomenally well, even by the standards of Rosanna Alan Khan's very good performance there in 2017. And that's clear also if you look at
What was the other place he did well?
And in Jewish areas with large Jewish populations, he did better than Labour did in 2016.
Because that guy's been to a lot of synagogues.
And you can see this again when you look at the 2017 performance of Andy Burnham. And then when you compare Andy and Sadiq's performance with how Labour did in these local elections, obviously a much better set of local elections as far as Labour's poll position and also in terms of its performance as far as the projected national vote share. And it is clear across those elections that Sadiq did not win that election himself. He won it as a Labour candidate.
Okay, now, so you do agree with me then, which is that actually she had a route to winning it, a perfectly plausible route, but it wouldn't have been the same route that he took.
No, it would have been exactly the same route, and then she would have probably done much better in Dulwich and West Norwood than anywhere else, because she was liked there and had been an MP there for a long time. She would have done better with the because the other.
But would the Tories have done better at finding a tax on her that actually didn't just repel people? Could they have painted her as a sort of establishment?
So,
she's been around for a long time, whereas, you know, fresh, young, perky millionaire upstart Zach Goldsmith.
But yeah, then you're just like saying that a kindly old lady who kind of conveys warmth is tired and old. And I don't think that's a good place to be in either. And I think in terms of, you sort of have to, I think, you know, the question in terms of it being different is you have to go, well, where did Sadiq do better than she wouldn't have? Tooting, obviously. And again, the lesson from the local elections is that, although this didn't hold in Barnet, although the swings were not as bad in Barnet as they were in places where candidates were standing down, you know, Kersal or whatever in Salford, the performance of incumbents where they have a strong relationship with the community is consistently better. The community felt less annoyed with the Labour Party in 2016 than it did in 2018. And so I just don't buy that Tessa Jowell wouldn't also have done as well in those. I mean, this is the thing. It's annoying for many of us because lots of us have been very rude about Andy Burnham's leadership campaign, and some of the people who worked from that leadership campaign were hard to take. But
he's good at politics. It is Stephen.
Increasingly
say it, clear. Say it, say
no, the thing is, it is increasingly clear that if you want to point at a politician who's run for a metro mayoralty and go, "This guy has done better than we would expect," it's Andy Burnham. It's not Sadiq.
Well, I think that's a good point to end. Sorry, Andy, for all the things that Stephen has said about, and let John say about you, let's be honest. And
I was actually one of the nicest people about him during that leadership election, just throwing that out there.
He's got lovely eyes. That's anyway, true. On that note.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil and is licensed by Creative Commons. If you've enjoyed the New Statesman podcast, please leave us a favourable review on iTunes.
Tired of ads barging into your favourite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.